Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg.
It's hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 86. Today we have, as you can see, full screen here, we've got Justin Wilson with us.
Howdy, howdy.
There he goes. And then also, you've got a nice mugshot of Thomas Kurnack here.
Hello, everyone.
Excellent. And I'm on a remote location, so I'm away from home, so I've got this lovely echo that you guys get to listen to. You're welcome. You're welcome, everyone. All right. So let's see. What's coming up? Let's see. Let's get the first little bit out of the way. We have a few new patrons. We have Danny Gilbert, Tyre Burme, I think, and Pedro Reese, thank you guys for jumping in, becoming patrons. And part of becoming a patron is you get access to a patron-only Slack where a lot of good information is shared. That's patreon.com/thebrotherswiss. We also have a sponsor. It's Pennytone. So it's the easy button for delivering VoIP services to your business and their customers. They are doing a monthly special. I believe it's $10 per extension per month. You can go to pennytone.com and look at the I'm laughing already because Dave told me to pop over there and look at the terms and conditions. He's actually got some customized terms and conditions that's fairly humorous for anybody who listens to this podcast. So be sure to jump over there and take a look. $10 a month, not a bad deal. He does all the heavy lifting. You get to just hand phones to your customers. It's kind of a nice little arrangement there. All right, so I've also got a little bit of follow-up. So the last time we talked about the G-Pen, and Thomas and I had questions about distance limitations of the G-Pen to G-Pen devices. Somebody told me that it from G-Pen to G-Pen, it's 210 meters. G-Pen to a standard Ethernet device, it's your regular 100 meters that you would see. So just kind of a little update. Thank you for anonymous person that clarified that information. I think the first thing that's kind of interesting that's been getting a lot of press lately is the MikroTik bug that's been announced, CVE-2018-19299. And it's, I believe, scheduled to be released into the wild in 10 days. So there's going to be, I'm not sure what event it's going to happen at, but they're going to actually
It's a UK operators group meetup, so something like VISPA in US, but for UK and for different network operators, but similar organization.
There you go. So I'm not sure, when did they disclose that they were going to... Well, I mean, they said that they had been telling MikroTik for a little bit about it, right?
So the MikroTik supposedly has known about this, and MikroTik originally called it bug, but I think it's fair to call it an exploit or a vulnerability. Specifically, is a denial of service vulnerability, as it allows you to basically reboot a router remotely without authentication, without anything. And so supposedly MikroTik has known about this for a year now, and last week it was announced that the details of the vulnerability will go public at the UK operator group. There will be a presentation which a certain person is doing, and that's the public announcement deadline.
Gotcha. And so this leak, it is kind of a memory leak, right? But it's only IPv6 specific, correct?
Yes, so it's a memory leak in kernel processing of IPv6 packets. You can inject this into any IPv6 packet, firewall. So far, so to be 100% clear, we don't know the full details of this yet. Multiple people have managed to reproduce this quite easily with the readily available open source tools, so you can just run Kali Linux, and there is IPv6 penetration tools there, and you can fairly easily replicate this. But the full details of this are not yet public. We just know it's in IPv6 packet processing within kernel, or the kernel version that RouterOS is currently using.
And when you say packet processing, it's not necessarily things destined to that router. It's just packets moving through the router, correct?
Yeah, well, you still have to process the IPv6 packet even if you are just forwarding it.
Right, right.
And so it's enough that the router is forwarding the IPv6 packet, so there really is not much, or we don't know any particular mitigation strategies yet. Microtik have said that they will release a fix before it goes public. And yeah.
It's just not Microtik though, is it? Cisco put out a notice that they were fixing the same issue in a recent fix for some of their stuff.
I personally have not seen that, so I can.
Yeah, Cisco calls it RV320 and RV325. And the things I'm reading is it allows a remote attacker to inject and run admin commands on the device without a password, and allows a remote attacker to get.
Else.
Yeah, that sounds a little different.
Yeah, because that's an RCE, and the Microtik vulnerability is not an RCE. It's just a denial of service. It's a buffer. Basically, memory leak that leads to a buffer overrun and a reboot of the router.
I wonder how long it takes to exhaust the memory on a device. Like, do you think this is an attack that you could craft and implement within just a couple of minutes, or do you think it takes a couple hours for this to really
impact there on? Is a video of the original person who made the CVEs killing a CHR in a matter of seconds.
Oh, wow. So it could be pretty detrimental. I saw in the newest beta that they rushed out, what was it, 645 beta 22, that they're working on some repairs, but I believe the guy who originally submitted the video and all that stuff says that it's not quite fixing the issue.
It's not yet fixed.
Yeah, so I guess that's still a work in progress at this point. But obviously they are working on it, which is good. I mean, they're making stabs at it on the beta. I'm guessing as soon as they get it solidified, they'll go ahead and roll it out to the code trains with hopefully no other updates, just this fix. That way people, you know, will feel safe just upgrading really quick without having to test too much on their existing infrastructure.
Yeah, this one is a little bit hairy.
Yeah.
Because, so there is multiple fronts. First of all, I really don't envy Microtik that they have to fix this, because if this is a kernel issue, it means there is probably a fix already available in newer kernels. This means Microtik has to backport that fix into their kernel, and we know that they support a wide range of architectures, which means a wide range of customized kernels, which means merging or backporting a fix like this is no easy task. So I certainly don't envy them having to deal with this, but at the same time, they've had a year to deal with it.
That makes me wonder, you know, if they knew about it a year ago and were able to reproduce it, maybe they thought, you know, we'll be jumping to a new kernel version long before this is going to bite us, or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. It's hard to, of course, predict what Microtik internal discussions look like.
Yeah, of course.
Well, they address it as a bug instead of a vulnerability, so it could be how they're viewing it internally too.
So originally they were there. Even the person that found this vulnerability said that originally Microtik classified this as a bug, which I think we can all agree it's not a bug when you can repeatedly crash a router. So they originally classified it as a bug, which it clearly is not, and there was no movement on this front for a year. And I think perhaps indeed Microtik were hoping that they would be long gone from this kernel version, or the mythical unicorn of V7 would be out, and you know, that would solve all the issues, or we don't know what the internal discussions were. But it's also why I said this one is a little bit hairy, because the person who registered the CVEs and discovered this is also heavily promoting this across the internet. There are now even tech news outlets running articles on this, which is one way to do it. I'm not sure it's the best way, but so it's now been heavily publicized, and it's creating a lot of buzz because it is a serious exploit. And
yeah.
So I am not sure how I feel about this from both fronts, from the person, you know, pushing it so much, and at the same time for my critic for ignoring it for a year. And even if they do manage to get a fix out before the public release, you know, if you get a version of RouterOS that supposedly fixes this, and then it will be 2 or 3 days before the details go public, there is no way large-scale proper networks will have time for a full QA process to run on that fixed version to be able to deploy it in production, much less the time it takes to deploy to production in large-scale networks.
Yeah, did they go through like a, you know, a proper, what most of the security folks do is, hey, we go to MikroTik, we found this bug, and you're not responding to us, so we're going to go ahead and release it on this date, kind of to force them. Does anybody know if that actually happened?
There was responsible disclosure.
No, like Thomas says, you know, it's not enough time to go through a full QA process and all of that. It's just not.
Yeah, for a regular organization. I mean, if you're a few versions behind, right, and before we've always said, you know what, just make sure you have a good firewall in place and you're protected. You don't have to worry about it. And so you could be a few versions behind and still be okay. And to be able to kind of vet everything, you know, in all these new versions, I don't know, say they do get a fix and you've only got 3 days or 2 days or what have you. I mean, still, that's really not a whole lot of time to implement. And then, you know, some of the size of like Thomas's networks that he's worked on before, where you have thousands of routers, can you imagine all the various configuration nuances in each one of those, and how do you properly test them? I mean, you don't. You just got to go, you know, full ham and see what happens, I guess.
And does it actually fix it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess if a lot of your routed infrastructure is internal only and isn't carrying, you know, internet packets, maybe. Well, I mean, no, I mean, because all those networks are probably going to connect to the internet in some form or fashion, right? And these are packets that could be crafted from the outside and sent in.
Well, when the full details of this are actually public, it is quite possible that you can filter this out at the edge. It just, maybe you can, maybe you can't. We just don't know until the full details are made public. So there are possible mitigation strategies. There always are, right? Even the worst one might involve putting something else than a MikroTik in front of all the other MikroTiks and filtering in there, even just a Linux machine, you know, which of course is not easy. And specifically when you are a big organization or an enterprise or a government or a bank, it will not be that easy to just put something else in front of your entire network. So this is a really complex discussion and a really complex topic. Time is the biggest problem here.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a problem if this was, you know, 2 months ago, it was fixed and now the deadline was there for it to be announced. But it's a week away from announcement pretty much, and we still don't have a final fixed version, and that is the problem.
Yeah. Or if you do get mitigation strategies and you don't have any equipment to do it, I mean, you still got to order stuff. You still got to, I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah. It puts everybody in a pickle. I guess that's running IPv6 that's connected to the internet. I guess if you're internal only, you can theoretically, you know, hopefully trust your network that you've built inside. But
this is the first MikroTik DOS that's not mitigatable so far by firewall. Everything else up to now, just having firewalling would be enough. This one, sadly, is more complex. And it is a double-edged sword, because actually IPv6 here gives you also an advantage of obscurity. Now, security through obscurity is not a thing. That just doesn't work. Obscurity doesn't provide security. But at least exploiting this will be hard just to the sheer scale of IPv6.
And you're just going to block all of Brazil and China from your networks for a while?
I mean, the other way around, right? Like, the smallest standard assignment of IPv6 is /64, which is billions of IP addresses. Yeah. So if somebody wants to attack your router within that /64 pool, they first have to identify the IP of the router, which just scanning a single /64, which is the smallest standard assignment, is more than scanning the entirety of the IPv4 internet. So, finding a wild, unpublicized router that you want to exploit will be hard. Of course, this doesn't apply to anything you can trace route through, or you know, if this is something that hosts a server or anything else. It's a complex discussion.
Yeah, I mean, you could run a web server of some sort, and every host that happens to hit you, you just try and exploit them. You know, just run those packets towards them in the hopes that you're going to hit a network. But I mean, that's just blind firing. You know, I mean, that's not a targeted attack, I guess, in that way.
It's, you can target it. So imagine that you just know a single IPv6 address within an ISP, and you just trace route that and just fire a payload at every IP address on the route. And if you manage to bring down an edge router of an ISP, you brought down a town.
Yeah,
that's the worry there is you already know the peering address on a lot of networks. So if you're peered on IPv6, you just aim it at that address.
Yeah.
And that's one of my mitigation strategies is I've talked to several folks and they're like, hey, if you're not comfortable with it, just de-peer us from IPv6.
Interesting. Well, I guess you could also, if you wanted to target a network, you could send them unsolicited bulk email in the hopes that they'll click something. And as soon as they do, well, you've got an IP address inside that network. You could start exploiting that if you wanted to DOS somebody.
Yeah. I've seen some of the conversation in Slack and then, but it started on, I'm one of those threads on the forum where a couple people have been saying that so far the biggest problem with the whole thing is not even a technical thing. It's that the author of this refuses to collaborate with anybody else, and he's doing it mostly for self-promotion.
Yeah.
It's always me, you know, come watch my thing. And won't talk to anybody about anything.
To help the community with mitigation techniques and stuff, is that what you mean?
There are also two sides to that, because we know he has submitted proof and proof of concept to MikroTik. We know MikroTik knows how to replicate this. And for responsible disclosure guidelines, he actually can't tell anything to the community or everybody else. Now, as we've said, I think we discussed this or covered this a bit before you came in, Mike. He's certainly publicizing it a lot. He's certainly creating a lot of hype and buzz around this, but he can't say anything else other than comments in his presentation, because due to responsible disclosure, that's the only response he can give.
He's got to get sure, it
sure,
time.
Sure, yeah. but it's like. Sure, like, I understand, allowing them time to do it, but then he seems to be, like, going out of his way to, like, come watch my show, not like, yep, this is a problem, now moving on.
Well, part of it, too, what if he did develop a mitigation technique that you could implement on a MikroTik, and then as soon as he releases the exploit, he'll also say, all you've got to do on your MikroTik is this thing, and it'll circumvent it, or... maybe he's got some responsible mitigation techniques ready to go. Who knows?
Or maybe he's got his PayPal ready and say, send me money and I'll fix it.
Yeah, maybe and maybe not. And he is certainly creating a lot of buzz, like we covered before. So this one is extremely publicized, extremely dangerous, currently non-fixable, currently non-mitigatable, and we just don't know enough and time is running out, so it will be interesting.
It will be indeed. So since we mentioned it, the MUM is coming up in Austin this coming week. It's going to be, I say Wednesday, nothing really starts except for drinks, so it starts on Wednesday. It runs through Friday. It's going to be in Austin, Texas, man. It's in my backyard, brothers, so I'm looking forward to that. Any of you guys going? I know Thomas on the call is coming.
Yeah, we're leaving. We're leaving tomorrow to drive, so we'll be in Tuesday, Wednesday, sometime around there.
You're such an animal, dude. Are you afraid of flying, or you just really like driving? Which is it?
No, I mean we're going to use it as kind of a vacation. We're gonna stop about halfway and spend the night somewhere, and I got some work to do down there before the mom, so
that's cool.
It works out pretty well.
Are you bringing the missus?
Yep. Yeah, she's gonna come. We got a booth for the IX, so she's gonna person the booth.
Wicked.
I can't say man the booth, but she's gonna person the booth.
Going with Justin down to the New Orleans mum. I don't know that I want to drive to a mum ever again. That was we started in Champaign, Illinois at about 10 p.m. and just drove to New Orleans. That was a long.
My wife and I drove to New Orleans, Mom. It was about
long day.
A 7-hour right. drive. That was the longest car ride I've ever made. And I brought an audio book with us. I brought, what was that? 50 Shades of Grey?
Oh, jeez.
And, man, by the time we got there.
Were the windows steamed up?
Well, actually, the air conditioner broke, so they were rolled down the whole way, halfway there. But man, that book was a waste of time. I don't even want to get into it because somebody probably loved it, but I just thought the chick was an airhead in there. It was ridiculous. Thought it was about women's empowerment. It was not. So whatever.
It's almost 12 hours from Champaign to New Orleans.
It helped that we were doing about 90 to 100 through most of Mississippi.
That's ridiculous. Well, at the MUM this year, and I know Justin's down for this, I want to organize everybody getting together and go to Gus's Chicken on, I think they're on 3rd Street. And
we're going to stop in Memphis. That's dinner tomorrow.
and then you're going to come back and eat some more once you get to Austin. Yep. But it is the best spicy fried chicken. Everybody listening is invited to come. They have great greens, pickle spears. I like getting their fries. I'm going to make Thomas eat all of it. He's going to enjoy it. We're going to try and record a live show. I got some recording equipment that should theoretically pick up a whole room of people fairly well, which was a problem we had before. Also, Friday, if you guys are going to be there on Friday, Master Pancake Theater, it's like Mystery Science Theater 3000, but it's the adult version because it's all dick and fart jokes, and it's obscene, and halfway through, they stop the movie, and they do a little skit, and there's this guy, Erler. Usually you see him in a red thong. It's very uncomfortable. It's very Austin. They have food and drinks there. It's going to be a good time. And I was thinking, when we went to the Colorado MUM, that was the first time Thomas had ever been to an arcade, so I super can't wait for him to experience this. It's going to be all kinds of weird. Any thoughts on that one, Thomas? You excited?
You're just spilling out uncomfortable details about me now, right?
Well, I properly disclosed them to you previously, so I can't really give too much detail out to the community until we get to the MUM. That would be irresponsible of me. But yeah.
Yeah, arcade could mean a couple different things.
It was a good time. It was a good time. Colorado, I'm looking forward to Austin because it's a really fun town. So hopefully we'll see. I think right now, confirmed, we've got about 8 people going. So hopefully we can pack that place out. Got to get in there ahead of time because they're reserved seats and they fill up fast. And Friday, I think most of us have presentations on Friday, and then we have the Brothers Wisp panel. Which we have to pick.
That's on Thursday, actually.
Yeah, I think most of ours are on Thursday.
I'm sorry, Thursday. You're right. Thursday. So day one, because by day two, everybody's going to be hungover anyway. So you really want to get all that stuff out of the way. So it'll be good. And then Friday, we can just relax. Don't have to worry about anything.
It's looking at Thursday, other than Microtik staff, you've got Disher, Kevin Myers, and Brian Horn are the only non-Brothers Wisp people that day.
Wicked. One day we'll have them all. We'll have our own day. It'll be sweet.
Dave's on Friday, so we could get Then to move Dave back there up to Thursday, move one of those other guys off to Friday, then.
Oh, goodness. But there's some speculation, right, that there's going to be some new hardware announced possibly because the MikroTik announcement, right? So whenever they're going to announce hardware, it's always day one, first presentation of the day is when they're going to announce all that stuff. And if I'm not mistaken, isn't this one longer than the European MUM one? Like the time slot's a little bit longer?
15 minutes longer.
Right, that's enough time to announce a little bit of extra equipment. And there was a change log that talked about 25 gigabit interfaces and 40 gigabit interfaces, right?
Yep.
And they didn't actually say anything about that equipment at the last one. So what? Speculation that they'll possibly spit out some details on that stuff?
Yeah, which is really weird, 25 and 40, because 40 is an incredibly old standard, you know, for 10 gig channels. Combined with 25 gig, brand new standard, that is just a part of 25, 50, and 100.
Also a new interface type.
Yeah.
And the new interface type means likely a new unused chipset so far. And which can mean many things, so we'll just have to wait and see what surprises MikroTik has for us.
Anybody want to take odds on a 100 gigabit interface announcement?
I'll take version 7 before 100 gig interface.
Well, with recent things coming to light, your version 7 may actually be closer than we thought it was. Who knows?
Possibly.
Yeah, I'm not going to bet on that horse anymore.
Don't bet on that unicorn. I get you. All right.
It's quite some time ago, they made a forum thread about, you know, what do you want for big interfaces? And that was probably a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And, of course, I don't see it right now. It's not pinned on anything I'm looking at. But, I think they were looking at 100 gigs total capacity. Most chipsets these days, it's, you know, if it supports one, it's going to support them all. So.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Something else interesting in the list down there is Thomas put in some MikroTik stuff. I think this, you made it seem like this was follow-up from something before, but I don't remember any of this. What's the story on it, Thomas? The 802.11 indoor versus TP-Link stuff.
So this was just a interesting little job I did about 3 weeks ago, I think, and just because people usually complain about MikroTik wireless, this is specifically about MikroTik indoor wireless. So I had I was replacing some TP-Link Archer C4500 access points with MikroTiks. So the TP-Link Archer C4500, they're pretty much the top-of-the-line TP-Link access points, you know, the crazy gamer 8 antenna look ones, which look like, I don't know, something you would stab somebody with. TP-Link, of course, advertises and hypes these as a, you know, 5.4 gigabyte wireless capacity and all of that crap, which those of us in the know that that number doesn't mean anything, but it's still being advertised as such. And it's about $250 for each of the Archers, and we replaced those with $60 CAP ACs, MikroTiks. And they have 100% same performance within 1 megabyte per second of each other.
Wow.
And so that was because we actually validated the Wi-Fi. We validated if there was any performance differences between the old ones and the new ones. And literally with the same client, same distance, you know, same building, same location of the access point and client, completely same, you know, same RF spectrum, because we just changed one for the other. We didn't change everything and then test. We changed one, tested within 1 megabits of each other, and the latency was within 2 milliseconds of each other. So, you know, a 240 5.4 gigabit wireless performance, top of the line TP-Link versus a $60 MikroTik CAPAC, completely same performance. Of course, with the MikroTik, you get the full feature set of MikroTik. So we could, you know, we could VLAN the guest SSID and the primary SSID. We could do all the security that you can do on MikroTik, etc. And so each of these access points has about 20 concurrent Wi-Fi clients on them, about 50-50 split between 2.4 and 5 gigahertz. And yeah, so if somebody's complaining about MikroTik indoor wireless, it works the same as any other top-of-the-line, super expensive, gamery, super hyped router. You just have to properly configure it, which of course is very different. So, you know, I'm not going to not going to paint any pretty pictures there, because on the TP-Link it's just on off for Wi-Fi, yeah. And we know on MikroTik, if you open the advanced settings in wireless, you have literally 80 buttons and checkboxes and drop down menus to configure. So
what was the motivation behind this? Were they having problems with their wireless, or were you guys just taking it?
Yes, they were having problems with their Wi-Fi. And also, we were redoing the network because it was a network which was done by somebody who had no clue what they were doing. So those TP-Link Archers, each of them was actually in router mode. So wow. Each Wi-Fi was, oh yeah, don't get me started. It was horrible. Okay. So we were just fixing that network, and part of the fix was replacing those Archers with MikroTiks.
All right, cool. That's a cool little tidbit. I like that. As Garth Brooks would say, I like that. if you guys have popped in the Slack, here's a few of the updates from it. One of the ones which Steve said he's been having EEP radius issues for, I guess, I don't know, a month and a half now. On a couple of different versions, and he said they finally fixed it in the 6.45 beta 22. So that's good news for that beta. It may not have plugged the IPv6 issue, but it did fix the EEP radius problem. So that's good.
Wasn't that specifically with IPsec?
Yeah. That's 100% what he was having problems with. Yeah, I think he said most devices were working, but like his MacBook stopped or something like that. And then yeah, there's reports of it, and they confirmed it, and they actually have it fixed now, which is good, which was a pretty fast turnaround. So I'm guessing they got a lot of complaints about it if they fixed it that fast.
If somebody breaks an IPsec, and specifically, you know, Road Warrior IPsec that everybody uses, that one is going to get reported pretty fast.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see. Let me get all the MikroTik stuff out all at once. We were talking about the MikroTik CRS300 series. Going into production for a lot of us, I'm actually about to put in 9 or 10 CRS300 series switches. And those particularly have the hardware offloading, right? That actually works now. So you can do DHCP snooping, port isolation, option 82 on DHCP, VLAN filtering, STP. That stuff's running in hardware. So you can enable all these features, and it doesn't just kick it over to software bridging. It actually can still forward in hardware, which is really nice. Have you put any of these into production, Thomas?
We've got a few in production. So just the fact that they are in production for my networks means a lot.
Yeah.
And I think we've discussed this in one of the previous casts.
Yeah, we have.
The 3 series is now finally production ready. It will not be replacing my HP chassis or Aruba chassis. So my favorite L2 equipment are HP/Aruba 5406 and 5412 chassis. Those are just my complete favorites for any L2 related stuff. MikroTik won't be replacing that anytime soon because their feature set is not ready to cover everything we do, and it's just not up to those requirements yet. But yes, we do have CRS3 series in production now. They work. They do what they are supposed to do, and
yeah. It seems like on the 300 series, most of the features that are getting implemented are like edge user features, right? So if you're going to stick them out in an MDU, or you're aggregating kind of users in an ISP scenario, it doesn't necessarily seem like they're focused as much on enterprise features just yet. which I'm assuming most of their customers are going to be ISP related, right? So you start.
I think that will be changing with the new switches, specifically with the 10 gig switches. You know, 8-10 gig metallic ports. It's not really useful for an ISP.
Yeah, true story. Let's see, what else do we have Cisco related on here? Oh, or MikroTik rather. Here's a Andrew Thrift quote, which I really liked, because there was some discussion on stacking versus MC lag, and they're saying that they were going to implement one, and then people were pushing them towards one or the other. And so Thrift, very succinctly, in the way that usually only he can, he says, stacking is not suitable for highly available networks. It's a technology of convenience, not reliability. That was a very nice way of putting it.
And Kevin Myers on Facebook has strongly disagreed. But
I mean, you're right. Everybody picks a horse and they back it. I've avoided stacking in the data center world because I've seen a lot of stacking bugs take out entire stacks at a time, right? Which is fairly frightening. Whereas MC lag. So stacking is where multiple switches appear as if they are a single switch, right? So switch number two just looks like port accompaniment number two, right? And then three and then four. So they all kind of, management-wise, it makes it a lot easier. That's why he's talking about convenience, right? Whereas MC lag is multi-chassis lag, wherein you can do like an LACP bonding across multiple switches. So you have one switch, and it can go to two other switches on the same bond, right? And stacking, you can do that as well. But generally, MC lag, if there's a bug there, it doesn't take out all the switches associated with it, wherein stacking, I've seen it multiple times happen.
Yeah, it's about control plane. With a stack, you have a single control plane. With MC lag, each individual member of the lag, you know, is its own switch with its own control plane. Of course, it's always more difficult than just that, because even in but it's still a single technology that unifies many switches versus MC lag, which is just a way to build a LACP bond across multiple chassis which are independent.
Right. And I've seen some stacking where you can share multiple things. Like in Cisco stacks, you can actually share power between switches. So if you're doing PoE amongst the stack and you don't have enough on this switch, the power supply will actually pull from the adjacent switches, which I think is kind of cool.
From a technical perspective, it seems like stacking is a lot like a chassis, except worse. You know, there's one point of control, but, you know, you have to update, you know, there's less backplane, there's, you know, firmware updates. You don't update just, you know, one set of controllers. You have to update each switch's firmware independently, causing reboots and downtime and...
Well, I mean, problems. like in a perfect world in a stack, while you're doing that, that individual switch will go offline, right? And everything, or you could lose a switch and everything will be fine. It's just it doesn't always happen that way.
To me, stacking's always been the poor man's chassis.
Yeah.
Yeah, which it's a nice growth thing. Like, you know, if you don't need to buy a big chassis, you just need one switch. Then later, oh, I need more. It's better than going out and buying a new chassis because now you need a second switch. Yeah. But
and sometimes it could be more cost effective too, right? Say you only need two of them and as opposed to buying a whole chassis and then putting all the line accompaniments in there, even if it's not very many. Sometimes it's cheaper just to go with a couple of 1U pizza box switches than it is a chassis. I mean, there's a lot of arguments one way or the other, but most of the time I see stacking in enterprise, not in ISP. I'm sure it's not... I mean, you can't say that across the board, because I'm sure there's some ISPs listening right now that have had nothing but success with their stacks, right? It's just kind of personal experience and what you've run into in the past, I think, a lot of times. So.
Well, and especially in, like, the Cisco world, if you say, hey, I'm going to grow into the stack, by the time you're, you know, ready to grow into the stack, the model numbers probably change, so now you have hardware to deal with, and, you know, hopefully that the, you know, the control planes on the back end are compatible, We've ran into that with the 3000 series, you know, especially with the when Cisco had the catalysts that had the lifetime warranty.
Yeah.
You know, they had a stacking model with those, and they changed the hardware somewhere in between, and they just didn't work right.
Such is life. That's why we've got these brand new switches you guys can buy. You'll love them.
Yep.
So yep. That's your, we'll, that's your,
we'll
migration
give, we'll even path. Give you a trade-in.
Oh, man. Let's see. There was a lot of talk about remote administration clients. So people have mentioned Thinfinity, TeamViewer, NetConnect, ScreenConnect, LogMeIn, ConnectWise, Partridge in a Pear Tree. There's a lot of options out there. I've used TeamViewer, but I've only used it for like a handful. I've never had to try to do like massive, large-scale remote administration, so I really don't have a dog in this fight. But I just thought it was interesting how everybody kind of had a varying opinion on different ones. A lot of it came down to price, it seemed like.
Yeah, that's why I don't use TeamViewer, because the pricing. You know, I have Zoho, and Zoho's got a built-in client, which is, you know, really no different than JoinMe and a whole bunch of those others.
You guys have any opinion, Mikey?
I've used all kinds of them over the years. One of my clients, you know, they were kind of what I used there. We are looking at, hopefully soon we'll move the PBX over to 3CX, and 3CX has a interactive screen sharing component of the PBX. So, we may use it for that.
But of course they do. That's wild. Hey, we're a PBX phone company. Let's add a thin client. That's interesting.
It's I'm guessing it started with, you know, they had voice conferencing, so then they added web, or, you know, video conferencing. Then when you had video, you know, conferencing, then, well, you know, I want to share my screen, and then on and on and on. Actually, as a bit of a tangent on that, I haven't used it yet, but I just saw last week, or this week, they came out with their version 16, which includes a module that will do website chat, will sync right in with the, like, your company chat, and then you can click a button and convert your website chat into a voice call on the PBX.
That's cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, just, you know, it's nice to see that kind of innovation from, so when you look at, you're just finding ways of spreading their product into other stuff, and as long as it works, then good.
That's super cool. All right. Let me, unlike normal days, I actually did some work a little bit this week. Unfortunately, I hate doing work. But I converted one of my 7200 chassis to an ASR 9000 setup. And when you're going from regular iOS to iOS XR, there's a pretty good bit of changes. Most things are sort of in the same places, but they go about it in weird ways. And there was one thing I found out that was interesting, like on the ASR 9000 line cards, you have to add 14 bytes to your MTU. So, like, we had two peers connected directly to each other, both at 1524 MTU, and OSPF wouldn't come up, right? Because if OSPF, if the MTU is different, when it does the DBD exchange, it goes at the max MTU. Well, even though they were reporting the same on the AS, the ASR 9000, I actually had to add 14 bytes to it. So I had to set it to like 1538. And then for whatever reason, it like shaves that off whenever it transmits packets, and then everything was happy. So there was a lot of just, oh, really annoying oddities.
Just make it all 9,000.
You could.
9,000 for everything.
I'd have to make it 9,014. That'd be the problem. You always have to, like, manually add. Unless you're going to ASR to ASR, you have to remember to do that mental math. It's, I thought that was really,
this is actually fairly common between vendors, because what those 14 bytes are, it's the L2 headers.
Yeah, it's the layer 2.
And some vendors count the L2 headers into L2 MTU, and some vendors don't. And it's really annoying because when you talk about MTU, you know, you have to talk about it at every layer, you know, L2 MTU, L3 MTU, MPLS MTU, L2 MTU with or without headers. Then if you add a VLAN, if you are counting those headers, then you need to add 4 bytes for every VLAN tag. And if you are counting until LTU without, then you just don't worry about it. And it's such a pain.
Yeah, but I'm going Cisco device, Cisco router to Cisco router. So it's like, that was just something I hadn't anticipated running into being a problem. And I had to debug it. I had to throw debugging on OSPF on my routers to figure it out. But, you know, what I fail to remember is that this is actually a Linux that happens to have running on routing running on top of it, because like in the other routers, if you wanted to look at like the CPU utilization, you show proc CPU history, and it'll give you a nice little graph. On these routers, you run the top command, like it's Linux, you know, and you see everything in there. You can get to a command line, you know. It's whenever you
Even within the iOS, you have those differences, right? Because you have iOS and then you have iOS XE.
Yeah.
And XE is also built on top of Linux.
Yeah. So it's just, there's a lot of different variations and flavors. This chassis, the new chassis, I really like how it handles things. You know, going from that older architecture to the newer, I had a full feed coming in on from one leg, and then I turned up a second CenturyLink full feed, and it fully converged all routes in 10 seconds. And that was just... bananas. So that was just a couple of full feeds, and I looked at the memory utilization. It's like, I don't know, 7 or 8% utilization on it, and the CPU never even flickered. It's just, these are newer chassis,
so
made to handle routes.
So Greg, you went from a Windows 95 laptop to a brand new Windows 10 SSD.
Yeah, pretty much. yeah. It's. I mean, it's a palpable, it's night and day difference how fast and just how smooth these things run. So I can't say enough about them. Once you get past the initial heartache of configuration, because everything is different, which is fine. You know, I mean, I enjoy the challenge, you know, I mean, seldom we get challenged really with things anymore. And so it was a lot of fun to get in there and figure it out. You know, I mean, I tested as much as I could, but when it was time to actually put it in play, there's always a couple of gremlins that pop up, and, you know, it's fun to get in there. You know, you've got, especially if you've got another engineer helping you out, kind of that teamwork aspect of it is a lot. I miss doing that sometimes. You know, when you make these highly available, super stable networks, they generally, you just make small modifications here and there. You don't do big sweeping changes like this, so it's fun to kind of get in there and go bananas every now and then.
I like on how on XR you're not editing the running config. So, you know, you make your config changes, then you commit them. So it's not, you can do a whole bunch of changes at once, and it's not affecting your running config.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Because you used to have
and
to
plus
do
plus
like,
you can have the two.
You used to have to do like reload in. You remember those good days? Yeah.
Yep.
Where
yep.
If you lose access, it reboots the chassis after X amount of time. Whereas this, you can actually have it, if all the commands don't commit,
you can
roll
do
back.
A feature rollback.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or config rollback.
Yeah, that's nice. And I guess Juniper's been doing that forever. But
now. So now that you have some new routers, with. Much larger capacity. Have you turned up any IPv6 peers yet?
No, not yet. I haven't completely migrated my entire infrastructure. These things are fairly expensive, so we're basically purchasing one a month for the next 6 months and rolling them in one at a time. But after that, yeah, the IPv6 infrastructure is going to get turned up, and that's all going to be hunky-dory. You know, that also
reminds me. And the big question is,
go ahead.
Did you buy the IPv6 license? That's one thing I hate about the X or the, you know, the 9000 chassis. You got to buy everything piecemeal almost.
Yeah. We've got everything in there, and all this stuff is smart nettable. You know, which is funny. Not to say it wasn't like I wasn't doing that before, but, you know, I've worked on networks with equipment that's so old you can't smartnet it anymore, so it's nice to have newer equipment. But yeah, we've all that stuff's ready to go. And I've purchased my black from Aaron. They haven't allocated it yet, but you know, all that stuff's taken care of, so it should be ready to go pretty soon. Speaking of other major vendors, I worked with Sienna on this other project for another customer the other day, last week, I think, Friday. And we have these big 8700 chassis with these 100 gig interfaces doing DWDM. You know, they're building these two big fiber rings or whatever. And this 8700 is the core one that sits at our data center where we're going to, you know, provision our they're selling internet from us as well as circuit to other providers and stuff like that. Anyway, they were bringing in the Sienna guys, right, so they could get access to one control and all that stuff, which is their kind of unified clicky-click manager that goes out and does everything. So they were sending engineers out there, and I had the opportunity to get in there and get that stuff. I got all my stuff configured. I got the firewall configured for them, but I didn't want to touch the 8700. That was part of their contract, right, was that those guys were going to do it. And I've worked with vendors, enough big vendors before, where I'll get in there and I'll bang away and I'll get it configured. Well, later down the road, they'll say, well, you guys didn't configure it per our standard, so blah, blah. You know, they pitch a fit, right? So I'm like, you guys paid for this. Let's let the engineers do it. That way there's no problems. They give us the template. We can't say we did something wrong. We followed the template. So they sent out two engineers. Turns out they sent us sales engineers. And man, was I disappointed. They had to get in one chassis, they had to move two VLANs across it, and it took them an hour to get two VLANs to move across basically a glorified Metro E switch. And I was nonplussed, sitting there in the data center, twiddling my thumbs with a ping running, saying, yep, as soon as these come up, it'll do the thing. The guy's having problems. He couldn't figure out how to do this stuff. And so I pull up some of their documentation, and I dig around. I'm like, is this what you're looking for? He's like, oh, yeah, that's it, blah, blah, blah. I was like, Jesus Christ. Why would they send us sales engineers for this, you know? It's just somewhat disheartening. But come to find out, it seems like most of their actual engineering tech comes from overseas. So most of the people they have in the States really are just sales engineers, so they're not really but even then, there was two of them. There's two of them. They couldn't even get a VLAN across their chassis. It's just blowing my mind.
And that's part of their training too. You know, that's I've noticed that with Sienna, they'll send somebody out, and that's their kind of on-the-job training. They have to have so many technical training credits.
That's tough. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to fault the company, or I'm not going to fault it's just. They sent the wrong people.
No, it's not their fault. Yeah.
They should have sent somebody else. Oh, well.
It looks like that chassis can take up to 60 100 gig interfaces.
Oh, yeah, it's a beast. I mean, they spent millions of dollars on this kit. They have multiple 8700s, and then out at the edge, they're doing 3930s to break it out. And those have 10 gig interface. I think they have two 10 gig interfaces for ring completion, and then it's got like 10 1 gig interfaces. But those, it's obscene how much you pay for this stuff. And it really is just, they're really just switches. I mean, they have some nice features and stuff, but everything configuration-wise is super obtuse. But I think it's probably pretty in line with a lot of Metro E vendors. But I don't know, I've done some Metro E stuff at Cisco, and it wasn't nearly this complicated or convoluted. But I guess it's kind of like, you know, when you have a lot of knobs, you can do a lot of things, you know, like Microtik. There's tons of knobs. You can do a lot of crazy stuff. Some of it's kind of difficult to figure out sometimes, but that's there. So at some point, I'm sure I'll know a lot more about it. I'm just not there yet. Anyway, that's my rant for the week, my two rants, I guess.
And it's one of those things you don't mess with that much either. You set it up and it kind of runs, and then when you go to add something else, it's pretty much the same config. So
yeah.
It's the hard part's setting it up, and once it's done, you
copy and paste.
That's why there's so many of them out there that are 10 years old.
Yeah, and I figured out how to do some weird stuff on them. It's just really tough, and even their guys on the inside sometimes have problems figuring out. I mean, they're like, they'll tell you, I know it can do this, just, you know, give me a few days and I'll send you something, because it takes them a little bit of lab time.
The CLI and the way you configure the SAOS, the service aware OS on Sienna, is really just unpleasant.
Yeah, it's weird. Like you say, Ethernet, set, Ethernet, and then the stuff you want to do. I don't know why. There's a lot of redundancy built into the command line for some reason. It's probably one of those early days where it's like, we don't want Cisco to sue us, so we got to be just different enough. Can I split and diverge the conversation to more of a thought experiment? So, do you guys ever watch the show The Orville?
I've watched it a couple times.
All right.
I think I've heard of it.
All right. So it's who's the guy that did Family Guy? What's his name?
Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane.
Seth.
It's his show, so it's like his version of Star Trek, right? And at first, he started out kind of really sort of slapsticky, and then it's really turned into kind of a more mature show. And so I was watching season 2, episode 11, and it was called Lasting Impressions. And so here's the shtick. This is like, I don't know, I think it's 400 years in the future. I think it's right about where they are. And they unearth a time capsule from 20...
Just like Star Trek.
Yeah, so they unearth a time capsule from 2015. And so this one lady, she had taken her old iPhone and she'd stuck it in the time capsule, right? And so they figure out how to revive it and get the information off of it. And so they're basically looking...
Wait. I think before we continue, spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler warning.
I'm not going to go too far in there, but just enough to where... I thought it was because they get this out of the way in like the first 30 seconds. Like, you figure this out. But yeah, definitely. Sorry. Spoiler porn, whatever. They find this iPhone from 2015. And so the idea is, you know, if somebody found your phone and they were trying to piece together a semblance of you, who you are, the life you lived from your phone, what would it look like for you? I think 2015 was probably a bad time frame to pick that from. I think they should have went more like 2010, because in 2015, everything we do is in the cloud, right? We just upload straight to Facebook or Tumblr or all that, you know, and so that's not going to live on your phone. But in like 2010, you know, you had tons of pictures, tons of video. Well, I don't know, maybe people still do, right? Maybe you, and then text messages, right? All the text messages you've sent, I guess all the stored emails you've sent, right? What would a civilization that far in the future think about you? So in this, they acted kind of like they didn't really know a whole lot. I mean, they seemed like they knew a pretty good bit, but not like a whole lot of, you know, the 2015 life on Earth. Like a day in the life. Yeah, there you go. You know, what would you,
for those listening to the podcast, you'll have to check the recording to see what the laugh is about.
But yeah, I just thought it was interesting trying to, you know, because it's like you think about like the people from Pompeii, right? They'll go in there and it's kind of a preserved snapshot of what life looked like in that time period. And you try and figure out, you know, how they lived and, you know, all that stuff. And so, you know, theoretically, if people didn't realize how we lived and who we were and how we interacted, what would they think about you from your phone? I thought that was just a really interesting thought experiment. People would think I was boring as shit if they looked at my phone, because I really don't do anything with it other than watch YouTube videos of people, like, machining parts. It's bizarre. Like, my viewing habits are, like, super old man-ish. It's so weird.
Well, then you have the American version, and then you have the Asian version where their phones are all tricked out and, you know, all the bling on the phone. And you have that not even taken into account the usage.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, you know, in the phone itself. Yeah.
I mean, there's more interesting things that happen in the show based on it, and I don't want to super spoil it because I thought this was just an extremely thought-provoking episode. Because, I don't know, you know, I feel like we're enablers, right? A lot of the people listening here are the portal through which people get all of this stuff, right? So, you know, they're sitting on Wi-Fi most of the time, and all that communication is because of us. You know, and so it just seems weird that we're allowing people to leave this legacy, this mark, right? It's all because of us in a way, in a small way maybe, but still, I just thought it was interesting that to think about how people could look at us in 400 years, and maybe we're the conduit through which, you know, that examination happens. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I always sort of have this this desire to leave a legacy in some way, right? Like what am I going to leave behind me? Because, you know, I mean, obviously I'm doing it through my kids and stuff like that, and through the people that I directly touch. But what are the indirect ways that we, you know, affect people? Because you guys are, I mean, you're making physical connections for people, you know? Like, if you shoot internet out to somebody's house and a 15-year-old kid, because this is how I was so super socially awkward that I learned to interact with people so much better through chat programs back in the day, through MIRC, you know? Like, I developed a lot of my social skills through that, you know, because it's that buffer, that safeness, right? And so
yeah,
a lot of who I am now is because of those things.
I'm not sure the IRC was all that safe.
Well, it gave the mask of it, right? And so I could turn it off if I wanted to, sort of thing. So it gave me, like, a buffer. And I guess a lot of people do that through text messaging now. That's their buffer, right? That they can, you know, it's like I was talking to this psychologist friend of mine, and she was saying that her kid isn't comfortable talking about sex stuff with her, which is ironic because she's actually a lecturer on women's studies and sexual studies. So it's like she's, you know, she's got a lot of knowledge on the subject, but her kid isn't comfortable talking to her. So her kid will actually text her questions, even if she's in the other room, about that kind of stuff. Right, because it gives that sort of that pseudo boundary, that safety net where she can kind of, you know, talk in this comfortable space with her. And I don't know. So all these things sort of connect for me. You know, the idea of leaving a legacy that somebody could look back on, and us being the conduit through which those people do that, I think is kind of profound. If you really want to piece all that stuff together, you know, if you want to snap all those Lego bricks together, it's sort of, I don't know, it's an interesting way of looking. Have you guys ever thought of yourselves as connecting people? I mean, do you ever really think about kind of the soft aspect of what you're doing?
Well, being from a rural community, I do. You know, we that's one of the reasons I got into the ISP business, because we were in a community that did not have any sort of broadband, or, you know, even really dial up back in the days. You know, when I did a BBS, our closest BBS number was 89 miles away. And so the being able to see how the rural community has come together using the internet over the years, and how, you know, some of the especially the older population has been able to talk to the grandkids, or you see these commercials where they do it all cheesy, and, you know, grandma gets a new Alexa show or whatever. But, you know, that stuff does happen on a real level. You know, hey, I sent pictures to my grandkids, or my grandkids sent me pictures, and they might be, you know, halfway across the country. So that sort of thing is, like you say, it's a conduit to let those connections happen.
Gotcha.
I just went to my Dropbox camera uploads back to 2011 and just started scrolling through just to see. 7 years ago, I was a Words with Friends cheater. You take a screenshot, you dump it into this app, it'll tell you what you could play. Somebody just full of dozens and dozens of Words with Friends boards. I'm like, what is going on? See some of my traveling. I forgot about that. But yeah, I was looking at my recent ones. It was all infrastructure stuff, work I've been doing, or at the, you know, Wisp America. And I see a wedding. Yeah, it's just like, you know, throw these pictures to somebody and just, you know, what would they think someone's life is like? Yeah, that's interesting concept.
Yeah. What would people determine based on that, right? If they were trying to, you know, say for example, you died and you were ultimately going to be judged based on what they could find in your browsing history. You know, were you a good person? Were you a bad person? You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it's sort of interesting stuff to think about, you know, it's how would that, how, but you know, it's just also, you know, rolling it back to the soft piece, you know, it's, I mean, we do what we do. Like Thomas, you make this backup software, which, you know, ultimately you're helping. I'm sorry, it's not just backup software, your full automation software, which ultimately helps people perform their jobs more efficiently and, you know, keep their businesses, you know, in working order and maybe sometimes save themselves from disaster. You know, but
well, all it's that stuff the, sort it's of, the butterfly effect.
Yeah, all that stuff trickles down, right? It's just you're one step away from these people delivering internet services. You know, and I think you know, too, the internet nowadays, it's like you don't even have to go to a physical college anymore. You know, it's, I think it really is becoming the future of education, is that you're just going to sit in front of a computer from your house or something. Like somebody was telling me about a college, I think somewhere out in California, where you can take all the classes for free, every single bit of it. You just have to pay for your tests. If you want to take the tests, you have to pay for those. So it's supposedly like a fraction of the cost of even like Phoenix Online or University of Phoenix or whatever that stuff is, you know. So it seems like education is just going to move that direction more and more, you know. So at some point, you know, we're going to be Ready Player One, just living in the oasis, I guess.
Well, I know several families who their kids go to high school online. They don't go to a physical classroom, and they just, you know, they just do it all online, and they interact with their teachers via the chat program and, you know, sometimes text messages, but usually it's all in one interface.
So I've heard the argument before that technology is pushing us apart, but I've also sort of read stuff about, you know, through the years, how various things are going to, you know, like from like 1910 about how this is going to push us apart and that, you know, and it never seems like it's the telegraph, it's separating us, you know, it's just, it doesn't seem like, it seems like they're, you know, just society as a whole is always evolving, right? And so there's always going to be people afraid of things or not. Do you think that technology like that, I mean, because like if you get all of your education at home, previously you were in a school with 500 people, you know, or 1,000 people. So that's a lot of human interaction. You got to learn to deal with bullies. You got to learn to make friends. You got to learn to overcome fear of crowds and speaking in front of, you know what I mean? So are we, does that turn us, I mean, does it make us into something else all of a sudden? You know, are we all going to, I mean, I'm such a hermit. If I can stay locked in a room and talk to people through a little window screen like this, I'm perfectly happy to do so.
Well, and then what does that do to the, you know, the social interaction? We could go down the, you know, the classifying people, you know, rabbit hole. Is this affecting the, you know, the quote millennials? Has this affected how they interact with people? Has it affected the way people you know, view the political scene? You know, is that a contributing factor? But, you know, on the lower level, look at things like Snapchat and some of those. I think Periscope's kind of died out a little, but, you know, Snapchat is a huge thing with the under 30 crowd, and that's how they get a lot of their interaction. And then when they, you know, when they do meet up or whatever, then, you know, it is a little different.
You know what's weird is I catch my kids talking in memes sometimes. My 10 and 13-year-old, they'll be saying something. The other one will look at them and say, "Hey, it's free real estate." You know, they'll just say the weirdest random memes to each other all the time. You know, it's just, or they'll affect a voice from a meme all of a sudden in conversation. It's like so bizarre. It's just, it's weird how it's leaking into culture these days.
Well, in art.
It has always been like that. It's just in a different capacity. Don't you know people that constantly quote movies?
Yeah.
Isn't that really the same thing?
Well, I remember in like fourth grade or fifth grade, we'd see In Living Color, and then we'd come to school and talk about the skit we just saw last night. Or, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I get it. It makes sense.
And are we becoming more of a kind of a centralized society? Are we not traveling as far due to, you know, various things because of things in the home and gas prices and whatever? So are people, is that their substitute for getting out and, you know, talking to everybody? Hey, I can just stay at home and do the same thing kind of deal.
You know, what's funny is as much as I like being an introvert and staying inside and all that stuff, when we go to the mums, I love those experiences. Like, that's one of my favorite things, is to meet new people, you know, and to hang out with you guys and to see you guys and just to hear your stories and hear your humanity, you know, and just that you are real people that have the same thoughts and feelings and struggles that I do. And it's just, I don't know, that's it's such an important part of my life, but I only get it like once or twice a year. It's so strange that I can I'm like a camel, I guess, you know, I just need a little bit and then I can sustain for a long time. But I think, you know, I mean, people are, you know, we're still animals, you know, we still have kind of biology that forces us to want to belong to a group of some sort, you know, that instinct is strong. So even if we can't get it in real life, well, not real life, but if we can't get it right next to us, we'll find it online, you know. And that's where all my friends are. All you guys are in crazy other states or crazy other countries, like Slovakia. I'm fairly certain that's made up. Since we have a flat Earth, it couldn't possibly exist that far on the other side. So, I don't know.
Well, and it, you know, it allows us to, you know, especially from where I am, I'm not going to find, there's maybe one or two people who share the technology and things like that, and I know who they are. Just cause we're in a small area, so, you know, we interact, but I think it's found people to...
Justin, saying it's a small area doesn't nearly do your area enough justice. There is one working cell phone provider. There's no McDonald's.
Do you have a stoplight?
The whole county does not have a three-collar stoplight.
Right, you're not a real place.
They are all... There are they all flashing, you know, red and yellow.
No, you're almost there. That's hilarious. Well, Thomas, you're the only one that hasn't piped up. What are your thoughts on the soft piece of providing internet to people and you being a conduit for that stuff? Because I know you still help people operate some ISPs, even if you're not in there every day doing it anymore.
Yeah, I just try to do my best at what I can do and what I like doing, and I think it's probably most people do that, right? They do what they enjoy and they do it as well as they can, and I think you will find people that have more, you know, social impact than us, and you will find people that have less. So I don't know, I just take it as a part of my job and part of what I enjoy doing. I don't do it because of it, but I suppose, to me, it's not really something that influences me, right? It's I like doing what I do, and that part, sure, it exists. I don't do it because of it, and I don't really focus on it, I suppose. Which, yeah.
It's.
I think it helps us to, you know, we go to these events, and we know the people in the room, the guy who always dominates the conversation, or, you know, the people who just, you know, run away with the conversation. And so, you know, interacting like this, it's harder to get that person that just dominates the whole conversation. So you're, you know, this isn't really one-on-one interaction, but it is in a sense.
You can come out and say Tom Smith. You can say his name. You don't have to beat around the
bush. No, there's much worse people than there's much worse people than Tom. You know, Tom is actually respectful about it. You know, he may get it on the rant, but, you know, he comes around.
You but, have Tom a beer and it's taken care of.
Justin, I know exactly who you're talking about.
You know, and when you get in that sort of arena, those people really, really kind of come out, and, you know, that's what they're there for, almost, it seems, you know, to get their audience and, You know, you talk to them and you can tell that they're not even listening to what you're saying. And yeah, I'm getting off on a little rant here, but you know, it when you're talking like this, everybody kind of is here for a common purpose. And it's just like the video game, you know. I've read I don't know how many stories of, oh man, I've played a game with this guy every day for the past 5 years, or once a week for the past 5 years. Never met him in person, but you know, you read those stories, and I consider him one of my best friends.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I met Andrew one time in real life. And then the next time I saw him in real life, I was in Australia, being part of his wedding. So it's mm-hmm. it's space doesn't really prevent you from forging bonds and stuff like that. But to go back to you're talking about somebody who dominates a conversation in those technical settings. You know, everybody's got this little man inside of them that needs something to feel important, right? Like that something he mm-hmm. needs. And a lot of those people, they need to be the smartest guy in the room, you know, to feed that little man. And I get it. Doesn't mean I necessarily appreciate it, but I get it. Thomas?
I have to jump in. Do you guys know Wait But Why?
Wait But Why? I don't think so.
No,
I don't
nobody?
Think so.
Oh, it's a great... it's almost a disservice to call it a blog. So it's not really a blog. It's a really super smart guy that writes very technical, very in-depth, very deep article about many topics. And waitbutwhy.com. And there is one great article, which is about 20 pages, I would say, about, you know, what drives and what motivates people. And basically, the title of the article is How to Pick a Career That Actually Fits You, which really does a disservice to how great that article is, because the article actually discusses, you know, the core motivations of a person and how each person has different core motivations and different basically needs they need fulfilled to feel fulfilled in their life. And you know, a big part of your life is your professional life, your work. Mm-hmm. And it talks exactly about, you know, it digs deep into those deep motivations of each person, that somebody needs to feel like they are, yeah, the top person in the room and they know everything. Others need to, you know, you have a part of you that might feel a need to contribute to society. You have a part of you that might have a need to make the world better, you know, or to do some charity work, etc. You know, like, there is always parts, those many different parts of you. It just, for each person, they have different priorities on which part needs most fulfillment and drives their decision making the most. And so I definitely recommend reading that article, waitbutwhy.com. It's a great article.
And, you know, you talked about it kind of occupationally, and I think that's interesting, because sometimes people, that little man, they need to satiate that need more than they do to be good at their job, in a sense, right? So some people will... I mean, you know, in those scenarios, you're almost acting as a sales guy, right? You're trying to sell them on, you know, if you're a consultant, that I know these things, and, you know, you would be safe trusting me in this, right? But their need to be right sometimes trumps the fact that they need to maybe not make this person that they're trying to sell their services to sound like an idiot or whatever, right?
I think I'll just read out a few of these, so, because it covers all of this that you mentioned, you know. It's just... Basically, his approach to this is that you have some personal goals that you need fulfilled. Like, you know, what is your identity and how do you present yourself? Your, you know, what is your meaning, your self-esteem, etc. And then you have the social part, which you have, like, you know, you want approval, you want status, you want inclusion into a group, you want respect, maybe you want fame. Mm-hmm. You know, and for each one, that, you know, those parts of that social life have certain value or certain priority. So if you are somebody that just needs respect and fame, you know, you maybe don't care about the technical side of things so much. And then, yeah, you just want to get in front of people and get that respect, whether it's warranted or not, or, you know. And you have moral things, right? Do you care about morality at all, about, you know, improving the future, about how you treat others, about the well-being of other people, of the environment, and, you know, what impact you are making to the society as a whole? And, like, there is so many different approaches. He talks a lot about practicality of those approaches, you know, will you have food tomorrow? that's also an important thing, right? Are you willing to go into debt? You know, how secure do you want to be about your future? How many risks you want to take? And like, when you look at a personality, a person from all of those aspects, and there is like a lot of, you know, you can usually break down people that are, you know, those super loud people that always have a need to stand out. You know, you can see that there is a reason behind it, and you can break that down and find out what motivates them and why, and, you know, is it warranted? Does it come from actual, you know, knowledge and background, or is it simply that person needing the social attention? And so I definitely recommend checking out that article. Yeah. It dives very well in depth into all of these things.
Part of that too, I think what helps me a lot is traditionally those kind of people, I really dislike them. You know, I just wasn't a fan. I couldn't get on board with that. And then I eventually learned that they don't necessarily choose to be that way, right? They somehow, generally through their upbringing, ran into a situation where this is how they define themselves or whatever, right? So there's like this guy I know that I think he was a child of like 13 kids, and so the way he separated himself was he'd be super useful, you know, he'd make himself so helpful, and it's translated into his adult life that his boss is like daddy, and so he'll do anything to please daddy, including shitting on other employees or coworkers or burning other people down, right? And so it's like, you would traditionally, I mean, you would think I would hate that guy or dislike that guy, but I had to eventually get to the core of it. It's like, he doesn't choose to be this way, you know, and I can see where he's coming from and I understand why he's that way. And so just through the act of understanding, I can let it go. You know, that doesn't mean I don't protect myself and be careful, because when you're around a gunner, you know, you always got to be cautious, but, you know, it makes it so that I can continue to interact with these people on a regular basis. And so, you know, just remembering that they are humans and we're all flawed kind of helps me in the long run deal with those sorts of people. So that's actually a really interesting article, and I think I might dig into that, man.
Yeah, actually that article goes even into what you just mentioned, because it talks about, you know, when you examine where a motivations for a person come from, a lot of them come from exactly external sources, external influences, and their childhood. And when you really want to, you know a person, or if somebody wants to know themselves, you have to dig beneath all the external influences, you know, all that was forced, you know, you really are about what you like, what are your priorities, and how you can use them to be better in your life. You oftentimes really need to find those external sources of external ideas or external motivations and figure out if they are something you want to keep or if it's something that you really should get rid of because it's stopping you from your personal growth, which this would be a good example from, right?
But so, anybody listening to this that does have something they want to change or thinks they possibly could, but they don't know how, that's exactly right. Like, that's the way I look at it. If I could have changed this thing about myself, if I could have fixed it, I would have already done it, right? Sometimes you need something else, either through reading or a mate, you know, a spouse, any kind of close companion that sees you a lot and can help you examine that, or, I mean, a therapist or something like that, right? There's no
shame. Usually the first step is to even recognize that there is something, and, you know, how do you even, the first step has to be that you recognize there is something you don't like, or that there is something you need to actually, you know, you need an introspection to, the first step is even seeing that part of yourself to be able to change it.
Yeah,
one of the first steps to, you know, enlightenment is you learn about yourself. You know, hey, I can do this good, I can do that bad, what do I need to work on? And then from that point, you seek the external help. Okay, I've looked at myself internally. Now I need to, you know, like Greg says, now I realize that if I knew about this, I already would have changed it. So how do I change this?
Yeah. It seems like with stuff like that, there used to be such a stigma, and I guess there still probably is, right? That it's like, you know, that it's like, this is, you know, mental health. It's you know, it's that means that you're weak. There's something wrong with you. You know, it's not, people just don't take it seriously, you know? And I know this is tangenting off a little bit, but depression is a real thing, right? And it hurts a lot of people. Something that really brought it home for me is I saw this cartoon on the internet, of all places, and it had this guy, and he was like, It was a rationalization of how people look at depression. And he was saying, this guy had this big gash in his arm, and he goes, can't you just stop bleeding for a second? You know, where people will say, can't you try just be happy for a minute? It's like, you know, it's a real malady that they really can't change. Just like a broken arm, you can't just all of a sudden not have a broken arm because you decide you want to. You know, that not just... you know, physical, you know, just personality characteristics, but depression and things like that. Sometimes it requires external help, you know, to get there. And so don't ignore that stuff, you know. Find somebody who will help you, someone who will listen. There's plenty of people out there that will.
Well, and then exactly. Industry... Go ahead. Well, in an industry like this, where people don't necessarily understand what... you know, a network person is doing, or, you know, what their job entails, or, you know, someone doing tech support. Well, you're just answering the phones. Well, that's, you know, pretty stressful job. You know, customers are brutal. We all know that. Anybody who's, you know, done a call center or done any kind of support know it's brutal. And then that wears on you after a while. So I think people in the technical field are kind of, you know, not to put anybody else down, but people in the technical field are kind of misunderstood. You know, you're the geek, you know, you just deal with geeky things. No, I dealt with this customer today that called me Satan because their printer wouldn't work, you know? And, you know, I realized a long time ago after...
I thought the printer was Satan.
Yeah. I realized a long time ago one of my weaknesses is I can't do telephone tech support anymore with customers. I just can't do it.
I've gotten to where I'm not great at that anymore either. Not to say I was great at it at first, but you know, you would you'd put a smile on your voice and you'd answer the phone chipper and you'd try and get your way through those problems, but it's taxing. I think that's one of the first things we try and get away from whenever we can.
I personally just lost the patience. I just don't have the patience
anymore.
To deal with that.
I think maybe it's burden of knowledge. Once we get so much information in our heads and we retain it on a permanent basis, it's hard to forgive other people for not having the most basic knowledge of what we do. You know what I mean? That's like, you could wake up out of a dead sleep and do these very complex things, which we often get woken up for. But this person has trouble turning their computer on, you know, or having to ask somebody, are you sure you're plugged directly into the wall? We had somebody who stuck a USB cable in the Ethernet jack one time. And it's, you know, it's just...
That's understandable the first time.
I've come to a point in my life where I don't want to take those kinds of phone calls anymore. Lord have mercy.
If you're used to the really advanced stuff, like, you probably, like, you know, you're thinking about, you know, some sort of, you know, device configuration problem that, or, you know, some device incompatibility problem that's causing it not to work. You don't even consider that there's a USB plugged into the jack, not a Cat 5. It's like that didn't even enter your realm of things to troubleshoot.
That's crazy. But, I mean, sometimes a dose of that every now and then will help you kind of come back down to earth. You know, because I work fairly regularly with guys from, you know, Fortune 500 companies. And they're network guys. They have network stuff in their title. Their signature has certifications in it. And... you know, I'm talking about the most basic things, and they've skipped a step, you know, and so it's how do you start at the bottom and learn to say it in a nice way where they don't feel diminished in some way, and And, you know, it's being okay sounding dumb or approaching it in the right way. You know, it's like, I know you've probably already tried this, but, you know, could you just check this in this form real quick? And
yeah. At one of my clients, like, I'm supposed to be helping this guy learn, you know, not everything I know, but you'll learn how to run things. And, like, most of what he's done, like, he learns well, but, like, most of what he's done has just been kind of try something in, and if it works, then that's what you do to fix it. There's no fundamentals of networking. Like, there's just no concept of what private versus public IPs are and things like that. And it's like, yeah, I'm supposed to help you, but, like, it sounds bad. Like, I'm not going to spend my time teaching you what binary is and to, you know, for, you know, to understand subnet lengths. You know, I'm not going to take the lesson, ask me if you have questions. Like, I can't teach you these basic things. Sounds bad, but it's like, I'm not going to.
I mean, that's what I, so occasionally at work, one of the regular NOC guys will say, you know what, the networking stuff looks really interesting, you know, how can I get into that? And I say, all right, here's some basic certifications, you know, if you start working on those, you know, and you get like the Network Plus, come and talk to me, you know, you get halfway through the CCNA, yeah, come and talk, you know, it's like sort of a two-way street, you know, it's like I tell them, I don't have time to sit with you all day every day and teach you the basics, but if you can show me that you're willing to learn and you're going to get those fundamentals, then, you know, I'm willing to put time into it as well, you know, and sort of, I guess it's more of a meet me in the middle sort of thing, right? I think that's so fair.
One thing people usually don't realize or like to argue against is that networking is actually quite hard to learn for a single reason. Let's say you go and want to learn programming, right? You start with some very simple stuff, you know, print line, something, you know, for I equals 1 through blah, blah, blah. And you start with very simple things and you build your knowledge, you pack more onto it, you start writing functions or methods, then objects, then, you know, you progress. But with networking, it's very different because in networking, you learn a bunch of protocols. And each protocol is on a completely separate layer and has nothing to do with the other layers and other protocols. So realistically, before you really know how networking works, you have, you know, four layers that you need to go through. You have a bunch of protocols, you know, from 2 through maybe 5 or 6 per layer that you need to learn. Then there is protocols which connect the layers, like DHCP, and that are in between the layers, and you just have to read a bunch of books, and then you have to read a bunch of specifications and protocols, and then, only then, you get to figure out how it all connects together and how it works together, or rather, how it's nicely separated into those layers, so that, you know, and it's a very different learning process than learning programming or learning, you know, web design or learning things which are nicely packaged so that you basically snowball your knowledge from a little tidbit into a, you know, ballooning and snowballing it to something like a mastery. With networking, it just doesn't work that way. And it's a very different learning process, and it's a learning process not for everyone. And so I actually feel that people that want to learn networking, it's tough. It is tough, and for most people, where they expect to see results along the way, like, you know, that nice programming where you start with print line and then eventually you have a program that does something. In networking, you don't have those little, you know, point-by-point objectives. You don't get that satisfaction of, oh, now it does this. Oh, now it does more. Oh, and now it does this. You don't have that in networking, really. It's a painful learning process.
You don't know anything until you know everything.
Yeah, there is a point where you can't do anything, and then you read for half a year, and suddenly you can do something. You know, but only after that half a year of not being able to do anything.
Well, and some of it is not absolute either. Sure, you have the constants, but, you know, like Greg was talking about with the MTU on his Cisco's earlier, you don't know that until you know that.
Well, you know, it's something that that I think really crystallizes it for me is I did computer science in college, and none of it ever seemed complicated. I mean, you learn pseudo coding, right? And you learn logic. If this happens, then do this. Oh, if else something else happens, that's so simple. I mean, even a small child can understand it, you know. But then when I tried to learn subnetting for the first time, all on my own, it took me, I don't know, a month before all of a sudden the heavens opened and then it just snapped into place. But I read so many books, so many various people's variations on subnetting until I read Todd Lammel's CCNA subnetting for the third time, I think. It clicked. And it's just, it's never in computer science was anything so obtuse that I had to just claw my way through it to understand. So I totally get what you mean. And like, even in the server world, nothing was ever that insane where it just completely made no sense, right? Like maybe, like when you're doing those web server configurations, Thomas, it's like, I mean, yeah, the documentation varied and none of it really was the right stuff, but it all sort of made sense to you at least, right? It's like, it just, I don't know,
yeah,
parts of networking just
slowly work at individual things.
Yeah. It's such a different animal, you know? It's, and then you try and throw in like wireless networking and how all of that stuff is just completely
crazy. And suddenly you have to know physics.
Yeah.
Because without physics, Jesus. Without actually knowing physics, you can't say you know wireless networking. You have to know wave propagation theories. You have to understand the EM spectrum, right? You have to understand just physics of how everything works. And without that, you really can't say you properly know wireless. And it's an area unto itself.
It's insanity. It's crazy.
I'm that guy on the networking stuff. I actually sent him, Udemy has a complete networking fundamentals course. And I do say it is quite complete. It says it's like, there's 75 articles as a part of this. And I said, you know, take these sections, break it down, you know, ask me questions. And so, you know, I just kind of give that to anybody that, you know, you want to start on networking? Here, start with this. And, you know, once a week we'll talk about it.
I still remember back in the day, my Linksys router, I didn't have broadband internet, but I bought a Linksys router because I was so interested in networking that I wanted to learn how it worked. And then I remember taking the Network Plus and then reading the section on NATing and being like, oh my God, that's what's happening. That's what it does. I still remember that. Oh, man.
Well, and we all learn differently, too. So, you know, some people are classroom learners. Some people are self-study learners. Some people are, you know, show-me-how-to-do-it learners.
And I just learned that when I'm not logged in, this Udemy course costs $10.99. Once I log in, it costs me
$13.99. Oh, that's dirty.
And I've already bought two of them for other people. So it's like, I didn't even buy one for myself. I buy them from other people, and they keep jacking the price up on me. It's like, what kind of deal is this?
Awesome.
Hook them for cheap and then make money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Lord have mercy. All right, guys. We are actually at an hour and 40 minutes. This is one of the longest ones we've had. Hopefully the tangential part wasn't too bad for everyone. It's my favorite part. To be honest with you, these are my favorite parts is where we get a little bit out of the technical and more into the kind of the cerebral part of it, where we're just thinking about the human aspects of these things. I really enjoy just conversations. And we're going to get a whole hell of a lot of it at the MUM coming up. So hopefully I can turn the mics on a couple times and record you guys saying some really interesting things. I'm going to have my video camera, so maybe we can do kind of a montage, like a nice sweet 80s montage, like we're about to go race somebody down a ski slope or, you know, punch sides of beef. I don't know. We'll figure something out.
Drive it through Austin in a Ferrari at night or something. Yeah.
Find the Ferrari. I'll bring the camera. All right.
Before we finish, one really, really important thing, which we should have mentioned before half of the people tuned out. By the other 40 mark. Anybody listening, please update your PuTTY and WinSCP and anything else that uses PuTTY. This includes M remote, NG, super putty, just anything that uses putty really needs an update. Right now, there were five high severity vulnerabilities discovered in putty, which allow for remote code execution, or rather, well, not remote, local code execution. So you can actually just open an SSH session to a, you know, attacker-controlled server, and he can infect your workstation just by you opening a session through putty and stuff like that. So please update your putty. Please think out for more than just make sure you're up to date.
And you have to uninstall your existing putty before you install the new one. I just found that out because I was like, oh yeah, I need to do that. So I just did it, and yeah, I got that.
I just use portable, so just replace the XE.
Yeah, that's what I do too. All right, good update. Sorry about that, Thomas. I can't, so since I'm recording on my laptop, I don't have the extra screen. I can't like scroll up and see the dock move around. So I missed that a little bit. Sorry about that. Any other closing thoughts? No? All right, let's put a bow on it. Wilson, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
J2SW.com.
I just noticed you're wearing a Wilson shirt.
Yep.
You're so lame, dude. All right, Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you on the internet, how would they do that?
Don't leave me alone. I'm busy.
Gotcha. Which is code for post something on Facebook or hit him on the Slack, right?
Yes, Slack. Go to our Slack. Then someone else can answer it. I don't have to.
I've been amazed. It's like most of the time, by the time I get to a question, it's already been answered like five times over with much better explanations than I would ever be able to offer. So it's great. Thomas, if people are going to get you on the internet, how are they going to find you?
Yeah, my usual answer, I'm fairly easy to find on the internet. Google for me, go to unimus.net, and those are the two ways. And now I am going to find a Ferrari so we can have fun in Austin.
All right.
So Unimus is doing well.
I can feel it calling.
He can rent one for a couple hours. It'll be all right. You can find me at Greg at...
Yeah, and I'm not going to eat for a year.
Greg at gregsoul.com. I have a blog that I have very rarely, but I'm about to put a bunch of just a ton of ASR tidbits in there that I discovered. I'm going to put lots of that little stuff if that interests you in there. If you want to find us, really the easiest way to get a hold of me is to slide into my DMs on the Little Brothers Wisp Slack. And so you get there by going to patreon.com/brotherswisp, sign up, we'll send you an invite to the Slack, and you've got access to 70 plus guys that are so much smarter than me, with a lot better attitudes, viewpoints, and obviously hair. I guess if you have any questions or comments, it's contact us at thebrotherswisp.com. We're actually going to have a website redesign with a new logo and everything. Hopefully by the time the mum gets here, it'll be all pretty. Let's see, what else can I think of? I guess questions, comments?
There's 95 people in the Slack now.
Yeah. So questions, comments, keep them coming. Hopefully we'll see you guys at the mum. If you want to go to Master Pancake, there might be a few tickets left. Give me a shout so I can make sure to reserve them for you. You talk about equipment and methodology, so sit back and start learning. Lighting up the towers so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.